Hello, all of you out there in Radioland. You're listening to KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM. For our virtual listeners, we hope your device stays locked onto our website, kptz.org. I'm Marianne McNellis. This show is called Our Town. The show highlights some of the diverse personalities that make Jefferson County, Washington so very special. Our Town profiles people from all walks of life, from firefighters to foodies, from bus drivers to baristas, and even the lawyers and the ladies who lunch. My guest today is someone many in the community know, Jamie Maciejewski, the Executive Director for Habitat for Humanity. Those of you who don't know Jamie personally certainly know about Habitat and the good the organization has done for this county. So welcome to the show, Jamie.
Thanks, Marianne.
Before we get to Habitat, I think our listeners would like to know a little bit about you and your background. So let's start there. Are you a hometown girl born and bred in Jefferson County?
I'm not born and bred here. When I was about 10, my parents started bringing us here, my brothers and I, and we spent a lot of time here when I was growing up, but I didn't grow up here.
So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Auburn, which is not far.
No,
but
it's not far.
It's not Jefferson County.
Okay. Close by, though. Now, I always like to ask about people's high school years because you enter high school, you're a kid. When you get out, in theory, you're an adult, although some people might quibble with that. But it's a very formative time. So what were you like in high school? But I want you to think about it, not what you thought of yourself, but what did your peers think of you? Where did they pigeonhole you?
I was probably a studious kid who was not too interesting and definitely not one of the in crowd, part of the orchestra and got good grades. And so probably some kids saw me as sort of one of those kids.
Yeah. So you were in the orchestra. What'd you play?
I played violin.
Uh-huh. And when did you start taking violin lessons? How old?
I was in fifth grade when a lot of kids start a musical instrument, and I picked up violin as part of the school program, the music program, and kept playing through my senior year in high school.
Okay, well, you mentioned in passing you and your brothers came to Jefferson County.
Yes.
How many brothers do you have?
I have three. Yeah.
And where do you fit in the family
I'm
order?
I'm the oldest.
Oh,
so I have three younger brothers.
Three younger brothers to boss around, I presume.
and I tease that they're my little brothers, but they tower over me.
Yeah, well, that sometimes happens. And what did your folks do?
My mom was a homemaker, and my dad was an engineer at Boeing.
Now, when you were a kid around the dining room table and everything, was it talked about going on to university? Was that something that was mentioned in your family and encouraged?
College was just an accepted part of the path. I came from a family where education was prized, and we spent time around the dinner table hearing about my dad's day as an engineer and the kind of problems he was working on solving, and he would challenge us to think with him about how you might solve something. So it was definitely part of the whole milieu in our family.
Okay. And was there any particularly school that was, you know, sort of earmarked that this is the one you should consider going to?
I don't think so. I think my folks would have supported whatever we ended up at.
Okay. Yeah. And where did you end up going?
I ended up at the University of Washington.
Okay.
Yep.
And what'd you major in?
I majored in natural science with an elementary education teaching certificate, which I never did use. I took the long route of getting that in about 5 years, which meant it showed sort of that I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to major in.
Okay, well, I was reading a bio of you, and you also have a master's degree.
I do. By the time I had spent several years working, then I knew what I wanted to do, and so I went back and got a master's degree.
And what's that in?
That master's degree is in a psychology area, but I specialized in organization.
So when you first were, you know, a newly minted graduate for your BA, what did you do first? What was your first big time job?
Before I even graduated, I was already volunteering and working part time at an organization in downtown Seattle that worked with homeless teens who were involved in prostitution. And I began working there full time when I graduated. So my interest at that point became social work.
So how did you end up there? I mean, what triggered your interest in homeless prostitution?
I was part of a group through my college time at University Presbyterian Church, and a group of us became aware of a man who was an Orthodox priest who was living in a mission in downtown Seattle and who spent a lot of time outreach to young teens who were there and homeless or runaway. And we had him come speak to us, and I was so inspired, and so were another three or four of us, that we started spending time volunteering there. It was life-changing to become engaged with these young people. Choices they made sense given the hardness of their backgrounds. A lot of foster care, a lot of instability, but they were not good choices in terms of health for them. It was a really hard thing to see.
Well, it must have been sort of eye-opening. Here you were from a stable environment, and you're talking to these kids who, let's face it, they weren't that much different in age from you.
Right.
And you were a college student, and they were on the streets. Did you have trouble relating to them?
I think maybe I decided that I didn't need to be relating to them being like them, that they simply needed an ear. They needed to know that there were adults who cared about them and who would listen and who would show up when they went to court and would sit and be interested in their lives. So I did a lot of that. And that injected, I think, for these young people, some sense of stability that there were adults who were in their life who weren't taking advantage of them, but were simply present to them.
So you were sort of a listening post.
Listening post, trying to help them find options for their lives that might work better than the options that they thought were the only options they had.
I realize it's been quite a while since you were doing this, but do you remember any particular case where it was sort of a success story that you feel you really impacted?
I don't particularly remember successes. I remember relationships that were really important and young people that were really important. I guess there is one young man who showed up on the street at about the age of 11 or 12, and I know that he's doing very well now. It's been remarkable to see him. We're connected on Facebook, and he's obviously a middle-aged adult. So proud of Justin and what he's been able to do.
That's great to have that sort of impact.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I was the impactful person in his life, but I got to help observe that happening.
So you started working for them full-time after you graduated.
I did.
Doing what?
There were only a couple of us, so I sort of did a little of everything. And after a time, the person who was the director left, and I was thrust into the role at the wonderful age of 25 of being the executive director there.
What was the organization called?
New Horizons Ministries, and it still does exist. It is doing housing and job training and so on for young people in downtown Seattle.
And is it directly affiliated with any church group, or is it just independent?
Many church groups support it and are involved with it, a whole range.
Okay. Yeah. And how long did you stay with them?
All told, including my volunteer time, I was there 4 years. So not a long time, but long enough that I knew that being involved with young people and involved in places that volunteers could do something important was really meaningful in my life.
Okay. Was that the point where you went back to school for a degree?
Not yet. Okay. I thought about it. I came close to starting a program at that point, but I moved to Portland then for another position that was also working with the same kind of a population of young people. And about that time, I became also involved as a volunteer again with a program known nationally as Court-Appointed Special Advocates, or CASA, also known locally in Washington more often as Guardian Ad Litem, or GAL. Trains volunteers to be advocates for children who've been abused or neglected and often are in foster care. And I did that because I realized how much of the background of these young teens who had run away was often that kind of background. Sometimes have set it upstream to where maybe more difference could be made earlier in a young person's life. So after I'd been in Portland just a year, I switched my work and became involved with a fledgling startup called Court Appointed Special Advocates in Portland. And I stayed there 10 years and became the executive director there.
Hmm. Does that group still exist?
Oh, yes, it does.
Great. Mm-hmm. Great. Well, 10 years is a pretty long run. Why did you decide to leave there?
I had gotten married and our first child was arriving and it was time for a rest. I mean, a different kind of rest, obviously. Yeah. Being a mom and staying home with your youngster is not restful necessarily. It's just a different kind of work. And I was really eager to do that. So I took a period of time that I got to be home with my became two children.
Okay. And were you still in Portland during this time?
Yes. In Portland until right after 9/11, and then we moved to this area.
Was there a trigger that, you know, caused you to come to this area versus anything else?
We came to this area. My parents were here, and so we would visit, and my husband was between jobs, and he happened to see a position in this area and apply for it and was hired. And so we moved to this area right after 9/11. It's very burned in my memory, the connection with that date. And our oldest son at that point was in kindergarten and just starting kindergarten. And so we were able to move and be near my parents and enjoy that and see our sons grow up in the local schools. And we've really enjoyed being here. It's home. So we've been here more than 20 years now.
Great. I think you mentioned that you actually live on Marrowstone.
Yes.
Nice. Did you move into a house that was already built, or were you one of the people that went and built your own?
We contracted our house, and someone built it for us, but I was the general contractor for it.
Well, that must have turned out to be a useful skill for you.
It was, yeah.
Okay, so how many years were you doing the, you know, mom built the house, that kind of stuff?
About 11.
Okay.
So quite a while.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And then obviously at some point you decided to rejoin the workforce.
I did. I was getting itchy feet and ready to do something. So I saw Habitat position come open for an executive director. It pulled my heart because, as I told you, Marianne, I love organizations where volunteers are involved in big things, where volunteers make a big difference. They're not just a little part. They're not simply doing make work things. They're solving important problems. Habitat is all about that. And when I threw my hat in the ring, it was a wonderful match, I think, for both of us, for both the board of directors and for me, that they were so eager to see Habitat continue to make a difference in this community and even do more.
So what year did you join Habitat?
2007.
Okay. Uh-huh. Now, I think most of our listeners have heard of Habitat,
yeah,
but I'm not sure that they really know about it. Could you just give a little snapshot of the history of Habitat?
Sure. Habitat started in 1976 in Georgia, rural Georgia, and it started about the same time in the Democratic Republic of Congo, known then as Zaire. It's now in 70 countries and 1,200 communities in the U.S. We build housing in partnership with people, a hand up, not a hand out, we like to say. And in exchange for people working on their own home, they buy a home with an affordable mortgage. I've seen so much good happen for that, and Habitat has expanded its impact in a lot of ways. It started in a, even before that, its roots were in rural Georgia in an interracial community on a farm there where people were working to do partnership with one another with equitable wages, equitable housing. Got a lot of pushback in the local community, but established a beachhead, I would say, Habitat began from that.
I think a lot of people also heard of Habitat through President Jimmy Carter and his wife. They've been very active for many years with Habitat.
They sure have. I would say the most well-known and famous volunteers that could have been. And we've so loved having President and Mrs. Carter involved because their involvement has been very important the visibility of Habitat for Humanity locally and around the world.
Yeah, I would think so. So locally, what year did Habitat establish in Jefferson County?
We are celebrating our 25th anniversary this year. It was founded in 1998. A group of local people had been working on it for several years. It's not an easy thing to start a Habitat for Humanity. You can't just build a house. There's a lot of other things that go into it. So 1998, though, is the official date that the state has.
Okay. And by now, how many houses have you built in Jefferson County by this point in time?
Right now, we've completed just over 60. Okay. And we have another 8 that are under construction.
Now, those are the ones, I think, right near Safeway.
6 of them are right by Safeway. That's correct. On Landis Street.
I thought there were 10 in there, but so there's 6.
There are 6. Okay. That's right. On Landis Street across from Katai, the nature park there, Lagoon.
And you can still apply to be on the list for that until May 15th. Is that correct?
We have an open application period right now through May 15, and we are looking for homeowners. All of the homes on Landis Street are currently spoken for. Those homeowner partners, they were selected last summer, and they've been doing their sweat equity. But we have 10 openings now for partner families. We will be building in another area in Port Townsend and also some in Port Hadlock, Irondale area. And we are eager to pass that word around.
Right. So I just want our listeners to know that there are openings and they can apply. And I would imagine going to habitat.org. Is that
HabitatEJC.org. Okay. That's our local website. That's a good way to do it, or calling our office.
And I want to quickly say a couple of things here. Sweat equity doesn't necessarily mean pounding nails. There are other things people can do if they are not physically up to climbing up on roofs and doing that, correct?
That's correct. We make sweat equity work well for people regardless of their ability. And I think many people find that they do lots of things they never expected to do themselves. And there are others who need to have adapted sweat equity, and we love to do that.
Yeah, okay, that's good. And in the program, you buy the house, but it's the land is still leased, correct?
That's right. This is a new model. We've started this year. So we sell the home, and Habitat for Humanity continues to own the land and leases it to the buyer with a 99-year renewable inheritable lease. So it feels like somebody's own property, but what it does is it protects for the future so that the home will be resold in exchange for an affordable mortgage. People agree to resell it in the future for an affordable price. And so the ground lease helps to control that.
Okay, so if the market is red hot, as it has been the past couple of years, if someone moves into one of these houses, and in general, houses go up in 5 years by 75%, I'm making up these numbers, but if you have a Habitat house, you can't sell it for 75% more than what you bought it for. What's the formula?
The market over time has appreciated at a rate of about 6% per year on average. The last 4 years, that's not the case. It's
right.
been much different. Habitat for Humanity houses are being sold with a 1.5% annual appreciation restriction.
Okay. So you could make some profit, but not the huge profit.
That's right.
Okay.
But in exchange, people are getting a house that's very affordable. Our homes are appraising well over $400,000, and people are buying them for well less than half.
But there are legal agreements that you have to make sure it stays affordable.
That's right. Our home buyers are paying it forward, we say,
right,
to the next buyer.
Yeah. Now, I really want to talk about sort of the future, and some of the things that are going on are changing the model, and you're doing some things, you're planning on doing some things out in Hadlock that are pretty interesting. And our listeners, most listeners know that there's a sewer system plan to go into Hadlock, and once it does, it's going to change the zoning a lot. So right now, for example, in general, if you can only build one house per every 5 acres, which does not promote density and affordable housing. And I'm going to have Bob Wheeler from the sewer system on in a future show so we can talk about it. So you and I don't have to talk about that, Jamie. But what I do want to talk about is it 14 acres?
17.
17 acres that Habitat bought. Okay. Assuming the sewer goes through, what's the plan?
The plan, the density will change and the zoning will allow 7 to 12 homes per acre. So that 17 acres will be able to have between 120 and 205 homes on it. Really remarkable piece of property right behind the primary school and the library. Walkable to so many things, right next to the bus, and the sewer will service it, which will make for a lovely community that will be very mixed income. All kinds of people in our community will be able to afford it, and it will be permanently affordable.
Okay, and how are you going to achieve the permanent affordability?
The permanent affordability will be achieved through ground leases and deed restrictions. In exchange for people getting something that's very affordable, they'll agree, as I said before, to sell it or in the future for something that's affordable.
Okay, but the ground rules are changing slightly, more than slightly, in terms of the income level, correct?
That's right. Only about a third of the homes will be Habitat for Humanity homes, which is under 80% of the area median income. That amount is around $65,000 for a household of 4 people. We will be having those homes, of course, that amount and lower, but we'll also be having homes that are affordable for people well above that, people who make up to maybe $110,000 in this community. So firefighters and nurses and teachers will be able to afford it. Our first responders will be able to afford housing there. And there will be both home ownership opportunities and rental opportunities.
Great. I think that's really exciting because that's a segment of the population that has really been squeezed out. I mean, they're not desperately poor, but the way housing has appreciated around here, nurses, teachers, whatever, can't afford to buy a house.
And we're hearing that people can't find a house at any price. We're hearing that that's just a serious problem. I mean, we just have so many stories of that and data about that.
Yeah, it is pretty amazing, really.
It is.
Now, this is somewhat of a guesstimate, of course, but roughly when do you think you'll be able to build those houses in that 17-acre parcel?
The sewer has to be built first. And we expect that to be ready about the end of 2025. So we think by 3 to 5 years from now, people should see houses start to go up and we should be seeing lots of building by that point.
I suppose the logical question is, when does the list open that you sign up?
That's a great question. We are right now selecting a master planning firm to work on the overall design and the financial plan of this whole project. We will know a whole lot more in a year. If you want to have me back, I can help people know, and we'll know a timeline and we'll know about much more about when we'll be starting to build. We'll be working closely with the county about permitting and when infrastructure will go in. I should just mention, Marianne, this community has been incredibly generous to make this project possible. We have had contributions from donors and commitments from donors that's of $4.5 million toward buying this property and developing the streets and the utilities and so on. So people want this to happen and we're excited about it. And I want people to be aware. In the meantime, though, we have a lot of work to do before we even get there with other houses we're building.
Right. So you are continuing with other houses and we're running really short on time. But another component of Habitat is the store.
Yes. The store is really important. We so appreciate people donating their wonderful furniture and housewares and antiques there and shopping. So don't forget, we have free pickups.
And the inventory there changes, don't just go once and say, oh, I don't see anything I like today, because by a week from now, there'll be a whole bunch of other stuff there.
That's right. And I also want to squeeze in really quickly that we do critical home repairs for people who own their own homes and can't afford or manage their repairs themselves. We particularly concentrate out in the county, especially Quilcean and Brennan, some in the tri-area. So when people have a situation like that, we hope they'll call us.
You know, I did not know that. So what you're saying is if you can't afford to get your, I don't know, furnace repaired, call Habitat. That's possible, right. You can get help there.
That's right. Your roof is leaking. You have an issue. You're relying on wood heat and you need that changed. Your septic is not, something's not good with it. Please call us. We have a limited amount we can do, but as I said, we're particularly focused in Quilcean and Brennan, but we have done repairs also in the tri-area.
Okay. Roughly how many volunteers do you have at a given time?
Pre-pandemic, we had 400 in a year. We have fewer than that now, but we are building back up and we need volunteers, Marianne. Okay. I hope your listeners will call us. We have a lot of work to be done and that we're doing right now.
Okay. All right. Is there a phone number that people should call, or do you think online? What do you think?
360-379-2827. Please give us a call.
Okay, great. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. Went really quick. You've been listening to Our Town on KPTZ, Port Townsend, 91.9 FM. I'm Mary Ann McNellis. My guest today has been Jamie Maciejewski, Executive Director of Habitat for Humanity. In addition to thanking Jamie, I also want to thank Sunny Flores, editor and producer of Our Town. Many of you don't realize how important the role of an editor is on a show like this. He can edit out our bloopers and make us sound so nice and elegant and excellent. No ums, ers, and you knows. In addition to thanking both Jamie and Sunny, I want to thank you, the listener, for sticking with KPTZ for the past decade. What a ride it's been. And soon we're going to be moving into our new quarters at the Fort, and it will be excellent. As much as we have loved our world headquarters in the parking lot of the Mountain View School. So keep listening to KPTZ, Port Townsend. I'm Mary Ann McNellis. I'm signing off for today. Keep listening for more dynamic, eclectic community radio.
Our Town is an original KPTZ production, created by Mary Ann McNellis and edited by Sunny Flores.